Thank you, Melody. Good afternoon, everyone. Just before church, I noticed I was starting to get hoarse, and perhaps that's good today because I don't really have to go a long ways because of the way things have worked out. So maybe I'll make it through this after all with no problems. A number of years ago, a lady who was working for me knocked on my door and said, "Do you mind if I come in? I'd like to talk to you about something." I said, "Sure, come on in." She said, "Do you mind if I close the door?" I said, "No, that's fine." So she closed the door, came around to the front of my desk and sat down in front of me and put her shoulders or elbows down on the desk like this, and you know, had her hand cradled in the in her hands, and or her head cradled in her hands, and she said, "You know, I've really got a problem." And I said, "Well, you know, what's their problem? What is it?" And then she proceeded to tell me. One of her customers, who was a client who was probably in her late 60s, had called her and asked her to come out and visit her. Well, that wasn't uncommon. I mean, we went out and visited our clients all the time. But when she got out there, and she gave me a little background about this woman. She had, as a child, a young girl, been in a Nazi concentration camp during the Second World War and had managed to survive by eating twigs and leaves and that type of thing. So she had really had a very difficult childhood. And as a result of that experience, she said and had resolved that she would never, ever let anyone or anything control her like the Nazis had. And that's the way she'd governed her life. So she was a little chagrined when she had an examination. A doctor told her she had a terminal disease, and I've forgotten the name of it, but it was similar to Lou Gehrig's disease or ALS, whereby because of the nerves and the way they act, people will lose control of their muscles, and pretty soon they'll atrophy, and you know, at the end they're incapable of doing anything. They have no movement of their hands or their arms or anything like that, or their legs, and finally have to be, you know, treated like a baby. And she told Carol, who is the lady that I'm talking about, "That will not happen to me." She said, "I'll go as long as I can, and when I reach the point that I'm no longer capable of taking care of myself, I'm going to take my life." Of course, Carol, I was very startled to hear that. I was startled to hear it, because what kind of a response do you give to someone like that? And Carol said, "Well, what should we do?" I really didn't know, because I didn't have any experience. I had limited experience with suicide. When I was in grade school, in the seventh or eighth grade, we walked across a bridge. A friend of mine, one time, this bridge crossed the Salton River, and we didn't cross it because we knew something was going on, but it just so happened that a woman had jumped off the bridge a little earlier, and it was about 200 feet downstream, and they had her out on the shore trying to resuscitate her. And there were people gathered around, and we couldn't really see a lot, but the thing that I saw and the thing that I've always remembered were her two white legs. I could see her legs, and they had this very, very white, bluish color, very surreal. And I remember having nightmares about that for months afterwards, and I think it actually continued for several years. Another classmate of mine lived with his aunt and uncle outside of Salton, about a mile and a half, and this was after we graduated. One day his uncle went out to the barn, and they had a hayloft. He climbed up into the hayloft, tied a rope around a rafter up there, and dropped down through the hole where they, you know, threw the hay down for the cows. I had a client who had lost his wife after about 60 years of marriage, and he lived in a retirement home down on Green Lake. He was on the 10th floor, and it wasn't too long after we heard about his wife's death that we heard that he had accidentally, quote unquote, fallen from the balcony of the 10th floor. So these types of things, like I said, I was aware of, but I didn't know anything about what led up to them, what led up to making the decision. So I talked to Carol and I said, let's call the Seattle Police Department and see if there's anything we could do or should do. And we were simply told, well, there's nothing. You know, she hasn't broken a law, and we can't send a patrol car out and have it parked outside of her apartment. We simply can't monitor people like that. So we didn't know what else to do, and we kind of, well, let's just wait and see what happens. And as the weeks pass and the months pass, you know, other business takes precedent, and you tend to forget about that. But about a year and a half later, she stuck her head in the door again and said, she called me and said she's going to do it. And within a week, the woman was dead. Now, I don't know how she died. I don't know if she took pills or if she took, you know, some kind of an injection or not. But it was a very unsettling experience. Well, there are Bible examples of suicide. The most notable one, of course, is the one of that we're all familiar with, of Judas and what he did. And also Saul, who fell on his sword and his armor bearer as well when he was wounded and didn't want to be captured. And then there's Samson, who at his death killed more Philistines than he did when he was alive. So there are examples in the Bible. There's one that I'd like you to turn to. It's in 2 Samuel 17, and I'll just give you a brief background. It's a counselor of David and also his son subsequently, Ahithophel. When David fled Absalom, because he valued his life, and he knew that if he stayed around, Absalom was intent on taking it. Ahithophel stayed with Absalom and became a counselor for him. And he told Absalom, because Absalom had asked his advice, what should I do? And he said, let me take 12,000 men and we'll follow David, and we'll, you know, he's not going to be aware that someone's out hunting for him this early. And Absalom didn't know whether or not that was good advice, so he asked another counselor who had been a counselor to David as well, Hushai. And Hushai said, no, you shouldn't do that. You shouldn't go after him. That's the wrong thing to do. And this was done because God intended for Absalom to die as a result of this. And in 2 Samuel 17, verse 23, and when Ahithophel saw that his counsel was not followed, he saddled his mule and rose and got him home to his house, to his city, put his household in order and hanged himself and died and was buried in the sepulcher of his father. He was very bitter because his advice was not followed. Here he'd been held in esteem. In the account of the story, it says that he was treated as though he was the oracle of God, that, you know, he was a very important person. Suddenly this was all taken away from him. And so this was his reaction. When we were in the Everett Church, I had a man that I used to play tennis with. And at one point in time, he retired, and there was a fire in his home. And as a result of the fire, his wife died. And because of the suspicious circumstances surrounding the death, once he had, and he was burned in the process, he had burns all over his hands and on his face. Once he was released from the hospital, he was put in jail. pending an investigation. After several months, he was released, and he came back to church. And I remember when he saw me, he came up to me, and the first thing he said was, "I didn't do it." I never asked him, and he never volunteered any information after that. But as we got closer to the summer, he asked me if I'd like to play tennis, and we had played tennis for years when he was a young man. And we were both comparable. On any given day, he might win, or on any given day, I might win, depending upon a variety of things. So it was a pretty good match. But because of the burns on his hands, he kept them bandaged partially. And because of the force that's used in hitting a tennis racket, sometimes after he would quit playing, even though he had them bandaged, there would be blood coming from places where the scar tissue had broken. But in any event, in order to make the game interesting, I let him play doubles on my side. In other words, I covered the entire court, and I played singles on his side, which was quite a bit more restrictive. And I tried to hit the ball directly to him, so that he didn't have to do a lot of running. And that was kind of a handicapped way of doing, but it seemed to work pretty well. Well, toward the end of the summer, we were standing by his truck one night, and he looked at me, and I hadn't asked him anything. And he said, "You know, John, I'm not going back to prison." And what he was talking about was in the early fall, there was going to be a trial. And I don't know if his experiences in prison before he was released had influenced him. And he didn't think he could handle prison. I don't know. He never said anything. He only told me that one thing. And I could tell by the look in his eyes that he was serious. But what I thought, the way I took it, I thought, well, he's probably going to take off and run up to Canada or something like that. I thought, you know, that's how what he's going to do. Well, anyway, the trial occurred, and he was found guilty and was sentenced to 10 years. And the sentence was to begin sometime at the first of the year. So the night before he was supposed to turn himself in, he went to dinner with his son and his daughter, and there may have been several other people as well, I don't know. But after dinner, he drove down to the Mukilteo ferry landing, or the dock down there, and I read this account in the newspaper. Someone said they saw someone in the car or the truck smoking a cigarette, and that sounded a little phony to me, but I guess at this point in time, considering what he ended up doing, it wouldn't have made a whole lot of difference. But anyway, he finished the cigarette, drove off out to the end of the dock and into the water. And I've often thought, after that happened, as the years passed by, as 2 years passed, I thought, you know, he would have served 2 years of his sentence. As 5 years passed, he would have served half of his sentence and would have been out in 5 years. And, you know, subsequently, until the full 10 years had elapsed. But he said he was not going back to jail, and that, you know, was prophetic, because he didn't. If you read in the newspaper, you'll probably see accounts of suicide with regard to our troops in Afghanistan and Iraq, and how the incidence has skyrocketed. You'll read the same type of statistics about teenagers as well. It's interesting, when you look at statistics, it indicates that in a population of 100,000, say, that 4.7 women will commit suicide, and 17.7 men will commit suicide, so almost four times as many. And that's all ages. As you jump to age 65, the percentages go from 4% for women up to almost 30% for men And when men go beyond 85, the percentage jumps for them to 65. So there's a factor in the age of a person that influences what they do. And I think, and Veronica and I talked about this, one of the things that's important here is that women talk to each other. Women have close friends. Women have a support system. Women are not afraid to talk about things that are bothering them. They're not afraid to talk about the deep, most innermost parts of what's going on, about their marriage, their children, themselves, whatever. Men are not like that. Men are, you know, we're the macho. There's nothing wrong with us. You know, we can do anything, conquer anything, and we don't need anyone else. We went to a round robin dinner at church a number of years ago in Everett, and Veronica and I were laughing about this afterwards because it illustrates the point. Two young boys from different families, after we ate, they were maybe five or six, I don't know, they each had a little toy, one a toy truck and one a toy car. And without talking to each other, they got down on the floor and started playing with their cars, running around this imaginary track. And every once in a while, one would kind of grunt, and, you know, there'll be a guttural sound, but there was no conversation. They just automatically knew what to do, you know. And that's the way men are. I mean, I'm being a little facetious here, but when it comes to communication, men tend to be that way. They don't have a close communication with other men. That's just, you know, the way we're made. That's not to say that's right, but, you know, men have that problem. Veronica was talking to me about her mother, who has been very ill with bladder cancer. She's 84, and she told Veronica recently she feels so useless, and she said, "Why don't I just die?" And Veronica has to reassure her. She says, "Mom," Veronica is the oldest of seven. She says, "Mom, you're the matriarch of this family. You're the one we look to for advice. You sit on, you know, your throne. You don't have to do anything. You are the one that is guiding this family." And she's been doing it since her father died. And that's, in a sense, you know, what has given her meaning in her life. And that ties back into these statistics on the elderly, how important it is to give them recognition, to show your gratitude to them. It's like we heard recently in the message about gratitude, how important it is. Well, because of the time, I'm not going to spend a lot of time on other statistics relative to suicide, because it's obviously very important. If you have family or friends who start talking about suicide, or they start withdrawing, or they start changing their eating and sleeping habits, or if they're having problems at school, or if they're having problems at work, they start giving some of their prized possessions away and start talking about making a will or abusing drugs or alcohol, all of these things are warning signs, and they're things that people should pay attention to. You would think, if you looked at statistics, that we in the Northwest would have a fairly high rate of suicide. And it turns out, if you look at some of the recent figures on the internet, Washington is like 14th in the nation. Alaska is first, and the District of Columbia, that is included in statistical information, is the last. I mean, they have the lowest rate, and Alaska has the highest. But interestingly enough, there's a correlation between sunshine and suicide, and it's just a reverse of what I would have thought. I would have thought, you know, it's gloomy, it's dark here throughout most of the winter, and it's you know, can be very depressing for people. But interestingly enough, most suicides in the Northern Hemisphere occur in June or in the spring. And they don't really understand why, other than to say this is one of the things that they brought out in their research, that people during the winter, during the time it's depressing, they're lethargic, they lose energy, and they don't feel like doing anything. But when the sun comes out in the spring and they are influenced in such a way that they begin to have energy and they begin to be able to do things, then they can act on perhaps their intentions earlier. They have the inspiration to carry out and to follow if they're going to do something like that. Now, I don't know if that's the way it works or not, but that was one thing that was written about it, and one supposition that perhaps, you know, was a cause or for those statistics falling out that way. Interestingly enough, in the Southern Hemisphere, the highest time is in December, which would be, you know, that would be their spring. So there's a lot of information that you can read about this, and it's just something to be aware about. People erroneously believe sometimes that willpower can change the way the person thinks about suicide, but that's not necessarily true. A lot of times there are hormonal things going on with a person that influences them, and you know, if there's a hormonal imbalance, you can't will that away. It's like if I broke my arm and I walked over to Dr. Lawrence Merritt and I said, what do you think I should do? He wouldn't tell me, well, just will yourself whole. He'd say, go down to the emergency room and get your arm set. Well, the brain is the same way. If it, you know, is out of balance in some way, you can't will that back. It's an organ and it has to be treated that way. I'm going to close by telling you something that happened to me back in 1975. I was in the middle of a divorce, and one night I was having a very animated conversation with my wife, encouraged somewhat by a quart of wine that I had been drinking during the evening. I don't usually drink a lot, but because of what was going on, I felt I could, you know, I should do something, and was my source of encouragement. But as the night wore on, my daughter Shannon, who's here today, she was only six then in the first grade, and she came in to me and she said, looked up at me, and she said, Daddy, why are you talking mean to Mommy? And I'm telling you, that really hit me where it hurt. And I decided after that, I don't care what happens with regard to our marriage, but I'll never talk, at least where the children can hear, to my wife, and I certainly won't, you know, raise my voice or be disparaging in any way. And a lot of that was influenced by the drinking, I'm sure of that. But the reason I brought this example up was I thought that that night there was a garage across the road from where we lived, and we parked one of our old cars there. And I thought, you know, how easy would it be to go over there and take a hose and tape it onto the tailpipe of the car, feed it into the window of the back, or the back window, tape it shut, go in, turn the key in the ignition, and lay down on the front seat. But I thought, you know, I'm not going to do anything like that. That's the only time in my life that I'm aware of it that I can remember getting a thought like that. And of course, we know that, you know, Satan can put those thoughts in our mind. But we can be so low and we can be so down because of things that happen that we can be influenced in such a way. Well, the final scripture is in Ecclesiastes 9 and verse 4. And for those of you who took the time to look at your bulletin, you don't have to turn there because the scripture's on the front of the bulletin. It says, For to him that is joined to all the living, there is hope. For a living dog is better than a dead lion. Someone asked me before church what this meant. Why am I using this? And it's simply this. When you look at this scripture and you think about what it's saying, it doesn't make any difference what is going on in your life. And you think of dogs, I think of the dogs that we saw when we were coming back from the feast in Bombay, India, running along the gutter, disheveled, dirty, gaunt, not having anything to eat. And conversely, I thought of the Warren Buffetts, the Bill Gates of the world, the Barack Obamas, men of high esteem. But if those men die, they're just like a dead lion. They have no more value. They can't do anything else. There's nothing they can do in their life. As long as you're alive, and you may feel like a dog sometime, you may be out of work, you may have a terrible illness, you may have a broken marriage, you may not know where your children are, you may have all kinds of terrible problems. But as long as we in this room, particularly knowing God's plan and knowing God's power and knowing what he has in store for us, as long as we can focus on that and keep it in the back of our mind, as long as we're alive, we can have someone take that dog that I was talking about and put him into a warm garage and wash him and take one of these fine combs to take the fleas out of him and give him something to eat. There is always hope as long as you're living. But when you're dead, that's it. So that's the reason for that verse. And that's important to us, that we know and we always keep that in the back of our mind, for a living dog is better than a dead lion.